the point
I usually come from. The age of coming is very dangerous for the human being. Human life is simply meant for self-realization, but due to this dangerous age, men have forgotten completely the aim of life. In this age, the lifespan will gradually decrease. People will gradually lose their memory, finer sentiments, strength, and better qualities. A list of the anomalies for this age is given in the 12th canto of this work. And so, this age is very difficult for those who want to utilize this life for self-realization. The people are so busy with sense gratification that they completely forget about self-realization. Out of madness, they frankly say that there is no need for self-realization because they do not realize that this brief life is but a moment on our great journey towards self-realization. The whole system of education is geared to sense gratification, and if the learned man thinks it over, he sees that the children of this age are being intentionally sent to the slaughterhouses of so-called education. Learned men, therefore, must be cautious of this age. And if they at all want to cross over the dangerous ocean of Kali, they must follow the footsteps of the sages of Naimisharanya and accept Sri Sukta Goswami, or his bona fide representative, as the captain of the ship. The ship is the message of Lord Sri Krishna in the shape of Bhagavad Gita or the Srimad Bhagavatam. This is the questions, this is chapter 1, is the questions of the sages, headed by Shamukha and others, posed to Sukta Goswami about the purpose of life and how to achieve it. And the last verse is one of those, there are six questions, and one of those six questions is coming up. That ends the chapter. The scene is the forest of Naimisharanya, and in that forest of Naimisharanya, many sages have gathered because through scripture and their spiritual acumen, they understand that the age of Kali has begun, and the symptoms of the age of Kali are very, very bad and get worse and worse and worse. And so their intention is to do something, not just stand around and watch it happen, but do something to give relief or serve as an antidote for the symptoms of the age of coming. Compassion, in other words, is something that's very natural for a spiritually wholesome person. And we're encouraged also to develop the quality of compassion and properly direct that quality of compassion. One of the presentations that I make at universities is contemporary manifestations or displays of compassion in our modern time. So, the presentation describes, just taking from dictionary definitions, compassion has three different parts to it. A cognitive part, you recognize what it is. An affective part, you have some feeling towards that which you recognize what it is, and some action that you take based on those two. And devotional service, similarly, we know from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 6, text 47, the last verse of chapter 6, Prabhupada explains, bhajate, this word bhaj is the root word of bhakti, and the implication specifically is practical activity. I mean, practical activity, then he spells it out, means senses interacting with sense objects in some purposeful manner. And we know from Bhagavad Gita, one of the things that Krishna speaks about is withdrawing senses from sense objects. But bhakti is engaging the senses with sense objects. But what it's the consciousness behind the act of extending the senses to sense objects. We can say simply it's compassion. Or it's service to the Supreme Lord. Like the discussion yesterday, Rishikena, Rishikesha, Sevanam. Engaging the senses in the service of the Master of the senses. And what's behind the activity is an affective and a cognitive component. The contemplation of what's the purpose? What purpose is to be served by life or by doing things or by not doing things? Life isn't optional because the soul is eternal. But doing things and not doing things is optional. And the purpose for which we do things or don't do things is also optional. It's that's consciousness factor. So directing one's activities towards the well-being of others, ultimately, the well-being of others is the well-being of, or the interest of Krishna. When the interest of Krishna is being the target, the center, the objective, then the well-being of others is also fulfilled. I remember having a discussion with some friends, or former friends, when I had become a devotee. They came to see me at the temple. They wanted to check me out and see what I was up to. And when I explained this principle, they shut down and almost, at least, they didn't physically remove themselves, but they removed themselves because they didn't like the principle. They liked the principle of watering the leaves and the branches and the limbs of the tree instead of watering the root of the tree. They just didn't like watering the root of the tree. And although as a devotee, I could understand both energetically what had happened when I said water the root of the tree. And why? It's an aversion. That's why we're in the material world. It's aversion to the personality of Godhead. He's the root of the tree of existence. And watering the root of the tree of existence waters existence. It sees to the well-being of all the parts of the tree, all the parts of existence. While one may attend to the leaves and the twigs and the branches and the limbs and the parts of the tree, one cannot forget the root of the tree, that from which the whole tree comes and has its life and sustenance and its nourishment. While we may attend to this or attend to that or the duties of life, the central part must be a thoughtful person must acknowledge and apply. So the seeing the symptoms, using the same metaphor, seeing a very withered tree, where in the previous verse, very famous verse, Prayina Payu Shakshavya, Kalavasman Gain Jana, Mandaksa Mandamateo, Mandabhavyagyapadrita. The word manda appears many times. Manda, Sumanda, Mateo, Mandabhavyagyapadrita. Manda means bad. Deteriorated. That which is good is deteriorated, and in its place is the opposite. It's ignorance. That which is not to be done is accepted as what is to be done. That which is to be done is accepted as that which is not to be done. Don't water the wooden tree. Water the leaves and trees and branches. The interest in the parts of the withered parts of the tree is not withdrawn by putting water on the root. But those that have aversion to the personality of Godhead, and this individual that reacted the way that they reacted, they're, in a worldly sense, they were good, wholesome, caring person. And not like explicit atheist, but, a religious, good person. But this, the aversion to the personality of Godhead as the recipient of one's service was repulsive. The sages of Nandisharani here, they're interested in the welfare of all the victims of the age of Kali, and that's like all of us, were presumably more or less, as Prabhupada said in any case, people in general are more or less good. But their association is bad, and the leadership leading and guiding them is bad. But the people are more or less good. So, part of our mission is to put something good in front of them, and the association is good. At least an alternative to the symptoms of the age of Kali, and persons that are carrying the symptoms of the age of Kali and thus giving bad association. Even a good person through bad association can become corrupted and then become bad association. So the Bhagavatam is encouraging, through the questions of the sages, Bhagavatam is encouraging, provide an alternative to the age of Kali and the symptoms of the age of Kali. There specifically, the sages are requesting Sukha Goswami to be their captain, the captain of the boat, to cross the ocean of Kali Yuga, because it's just begun. It's like, the shore of a very rough ocean, and there's a boat, and they know that they don't know how to navigate the boat to get to the other side. They want a good captain to take the boat to the other side. They see the roughness of the age of Kali. So in the metaphor, the captain is the spiritual teacher, spiritual guide, spiritual leader, spiritual master. They're submitting themselves unto Sukha Goswami, requesting him, very similar to the verse of Bhagavad Gita where Krishna is submitting himself to Krishna. Shishyasteham shalimam tvam brahmanam. I am now a soul surrender unto you, please instruct me. Like that verse, this is a similar verse. Please accept us as the members, the submissive members on the boat of transcendental knowledge. Specifically, Prabhupada writes that in the last sentence of the purport, the ship in this metaphor is the message of Lord Sri Krishna, the shape of Bhagavad Gita, or the Srimad Bhagavatam. That's the ship. And the ship needs a captain. I thought about this when, because every now and then I've been on an airplane. And one of the things that they repeatedly say is, especially when you have those, they don't just say it, it's like a little recording projected on a screen or shown on a screen. The posted placards and the instructions of the stewardesses and the instruction of the captain. I mean, everyone, like the captain has just told us to sit down. So they sit down. The captain has said, buckle up your seatbelt. So you buckle up your seatbelt. The captain has said, in part because flying an airplane is dangerous. You have to have obedience to the captain. If you don't have obedience to the captain, I can imagine there's like federal laws that you can be put in prison if you don't follow what the captain says. Or like at sea, the captain's order, that's it. And everyone does what the captain says. And if you don't, he'll throw you overboard because it's dangerous in the ship. And everyone has to be following. You need a good captain, and everyone needs to be following the good captain. So that's the metaphor. Similar metaphors used in the second chapter of Canto 10, very nice verses, the prayers of the demigods to Lord Krishna and the womb. Devaki is in the prison house of Kamsa, but her pregnancy is obvious, and her radiance is luminous. Her whole body is effulgent, and the beauty of Devaki is indicating the presence of the personality of Godhead within her womb. And so the demigods come and they're offering prayers. That's what chapter 2 is. Their prayers. And in one of their prayers, they describe a saintly person. A saintly person is one who, during this life, they're crossing the ocean of material existence, and before they complete their life, they leave behind on this side of the ocean of material existence the very means to get to the other side of material existence. Compassion. It's consciously they're constructing this craft, a ship, to cross the ocean of material existence, which is exactly what Prabhupada did. He gave abundant literature so that following him for generations, sometimes quoted 10,000 years, that's a lot of generations, the knowledge within his writings, the Bhaktivedanta Purport, would be the captain to guide the victims of the age of Kali, the sincere persons who wish to cross the ocean of material existence to be able to do so. And the Srimad Bhagavatam is exactly such literature. Vyasadeva, at the very beginning of the age of Kali, so there's the ocean of material existence, particularly disruptive and disturbing, symptomized by the age of Kali. Vyasadeva saw, and being a literary person, he provided the literature that would be the means for crossing the ocean of material existence in the age of Kali. Compassion. Sutta Goswami, having heard that Srimad Bhagavatam message, they see him as a qualified captain. The qualifications are discussed earlier in the chapter, where they say, Sutta, not only you heard Srimad Bhagavatam from Shukadeva Goswami when he spoke to Maharaj Pariksit, not only you heard it, but you've understood it. That's a big step. You've understood it. Not only you've understood it, you've assimilated the message. And because you've assimilated the message, you can speak the message. So we're very enthusiastic to hear from you. You're a qualified person to speak the message. That eagerness and pranipat, in the language of Bhagavad Gita, submission to the qualified speaker, or using this metaphor, to the captain. Submission to the captain, yes, sir, please, whatever the instructions that you give, we're ready to follow. We'll row this way, or put up the sails, or turn the rudder this way or that way, whatever. It's another little anecdotal thing. I was recently in Guyana. Once a year, I've been going to Guyana for about a week. And Guyana is just, there's three rivers that run kind of in a, well, they divide the country up into really big rivers. Berbice River, and the Demerara River, and the Essequibo River. When I was there, the truck and the Sotomayor were there, Essequibo. To go from one side of the Essequibo River to the other side of the Essequibo River, commonly people take a speedboat. There's also like a big giant, put cars on it, kind of a ferry. But at least every time I've gone, you go on a speedboat. And the Essequibo River is so wide, it takes 45 minutes to cross the river, to go from one side to the other side. And you can't, well, we don't go at the wrong times, because when you go at the wrong times, the waves are, it's like the ocean, because it's not so far from the ocean. It's like big waves. And it's dangerous. Like, the GBC of Guyana is a Virabhava Guru. He's never gone to Essequibo because he doesn't want to get on a speedboat across, you know, riding the waves. And some days it's calm. Like last time I was there, it's calm. But some days there's more wind, and so there's more waves. And so the navigators, there's one in the front and one in the back, and you know, they know how to do it, and it's really interesting. Anyway, there's a science to it, how to, you know, fly the boat in such a way the people inside the boat don't get totally drenched with, you know, the spray that comes from the boat as it's flying through the waves, and, you know, break the boat in half, because you ride away and then it comes down, and then you're up again, so that's a lot of torque on the boat. So anyway, they know how to do it. And everybody in the boat has to listen to what the captain says. Because it's dangerous. But if there's a good captain, you know, with a strong boat, you get to the other side. A little slower than when it's smooth. So we go really early because it's commonly quieter. The waves are less. Or really early as the day goes along, it becomes more turbulent. But you need a good captain to get to the other side safely. Like that kind of imagery, you know, fasten your seatbelt. Every time I hear them say that, I think, what they're telling you is, this is dangerous. And you're paying to get out to this dangerous thing. You know, well, how many times does a plane crash? But, you know, planes crash and it passes, you're gently, you're dead. Anyway, it's dangerous. So you need this material existence is dangerous. It's not like, it's tough. It's more than tough. It's very dangerous. In one sense, because the soul has nothing to do with matter, it's inconsequential. But from another perspective, by design, it's like a prison house by design is very difficult. And the material world by design, there's padam, padam, yadi padam, yate sham. It's very, very dangerous at every step. So how to navigate one's way through this dangerous circumstance? Going back to the metaphor, there's this ocean of material existence, and of oceans, there's the time when the ocean's waves are really big. You need a really strong boat, and you need a really good captain. And there must be a strong allegiance to and commitment to follow the instructions of the good captain. Otherwise, don't try to cross. But you really don't have a choice, because we're in the midst of the ocean of material existence. Kali Yuga is happening whether we try to navigate our way through it or not. So, thoughtful persons, like the sages of Naimisharanya, are recognizing the necessity of having a good captain. They recognize the qualifications of a good captain. They recognize the necessity of themselves to submit to that qualified person. And last point, kalim sattaharam hunsam. Sattaharam, it means goodness or good qualities. Haram, destroyed. And that means not just like other people, but also means us. Like, whatever tendencies, good tendencies that we have. The age of Kali is such that there's a tendency that they could also become destroyed. So what will fortify those good qualities? So it's, our Vaishnava teaching is two essential things. From our side, a sincere effort, and from Krishna's side, some descending mercy. And both are required. Sincere effort and descending mercy. The combination of the two makes for success. Sincere effort is not directed toward the Supreme, or the Supreme who's giving His mercy, we're not paying attention. Our attention is elsewhere. We're in an unsafe position. We're not protected. We're not going to be progressive. So, sincere effort and descending mercy. That's the combination. So they recognize Sutta Goswami as the qualified person to submit unto, and are eagerly submitting themselves to him. And because he has heard, understood, assimilated, and can properly present the message of Srimad Bhagavatam, they're very eager to hear, because that's the means of conquest. Overcoming the obstacle, or the challenge, or the great difficulty of this age of Kali. Okay, so, Vedic readings at 7:30. I'll stop and see if there's some discussion.
You're talking about this age of Kali, so full of mysteries and every step is dangerous. So, is there nothing good available in the age of Kali and it goes?
There's one good thing. According to the Bhagavatam, there's one good thing. The holy name. And from that one good thing, other good things expand.
So when people who are not fortunate in taking the shelter of the holy name, how bad the Kali Yuga is going to be in the coming years?
Well, the Bhagavatam describes it's progressive. It's not a free fall. It's a progressive deterioration. But you can read in the 12th canto as Kali Yuga becomes really advanced what the symptoms are. Good morning. Then your stature becomes pygmy-like. You know, the age of a person, maximum 20, 25 years. There'll be no vegetation. So that means people become cannibals. No following of regulations. Uncleanliness. Religious principles are absent. And those who are wholesome persons, they're happy. Because it's so vicious.
Quality from a
Vaishnava quality. How do we distinguish the two?
Yeah. How do we know that we're developing Vaishnava quality as opposed to?
Good question. My thoughts are going to a verse in the Bhagavatam that says without shouting the personality of Godhead, one will find no good qualities. I remember in Gita Nagari we were conducting before we were doing the retreats, there was this week-long thing of an institute. The Jai Gita Marsh was one of the instructors during one of those week-long things. And Sureshpura is a Prabhupada disciple who's traveling by invitation to different places and presents this seminar on Prabhupada's position, kind of a seminar, in several days. It's very popular. He'll probably come to Chicago at some point in time because he's invited, he goes all over the place. So he was previously living in Gita Nagari, so he gave a class on that verse. I distinctly remember. He spoke on the verse saying, well, it's not really exactly like that. That, you know, unless people have shelter and the personality of God, there's no good qualities. And he was describing his experience. At that time, they had a Food for Life program from Gita Nagari. They received donations, and he was the Food for Life person. They had a Food for Life truck, and they took meals to people that were in remote places that in Juniata County that were poor, and so he would bring them meals, hot meals, and he would describe his interactions with them, his colleagues with them, saying they're really good people. And that was his class. It was like, well, the verse, you're using what the verse says kind of class. Jayadvaita Maharaj gave class the next morning. He didn't know that Sureshwar had given that class. He wasn't there. He just gave the class on the same verse. And he did, you know, what Jayadvaita Maharaj is renowned for doing. He got his chopper outside of chopping. Really heavy. Saying there's no good qualities in the material world. So, one of the distinctions that he made was kind of like, now you see it, now you don't. Like, we know people that are, as your question is posing, of the quality of goodness. So we would say, well, that's goodness. But if it's temporary, like, and circumstantial, and it's the appearance of the real thing, that's the mode of goodness, mixed with the ignorance and passion competing, and then passion becomes, and ignorance becomes more prominent. So that's one of the ways that we can say, you know, stick around a while and see if that quality of goodness endures, or if there's something else that will replace it through passage of time. That's the mode of goodness. And transcendence, it's not circumstance created. That's dependent upon the circumstance. It's coming directly from the soul's connection with the personality of Godhead. It's sat, as opposed to asat, temporary. But one way then of saying is a distinction between the two. Here's three ways. In philosophically, the mode of goodness has a mix of the lower modes, and transcendence doesn't have a mix. It's vishuddha sattva. So that's philosophically, but it's okay. How do I measure this, whether it's this one or that one, which is your question? Stick around. And over time, will that mode of goodness wane and be replaced by something else? Because that's what happens when the modes are competing. Sometimes the other modes prevail. Whereas in the quality of transcendence, there's no competition, it's only one thing. It's pure goodness. Another way of measuring or evaluating is like the discussion last night about Rishikena, Rishikesha, Sevana. So a mode of goodness manifestation is what people commonly call selfless work. Philanthropy and altruism and selfless work. But the nature of the modes of nature, the way that the modes of nature work is, there is some interest on the part of the philanthropist. You know, Lava, Puja, and Pratishtha, for example. They the interest of their recognition, their fame, their reputation, or how they feel about themselves about doing such things. You know, out of my largesse, I'm giving of my abundance to someone that has less, and I feel good about myself for doing that. And that's subtle. How do you measure that? Put somebody up to a pride meter and see what happens. But it's the nature of the mode of goodness. There's something inside where I'm getting my satisfaction from. It's the happiness, as in the language above, it was conditioned by the mode of, but conditioned by the happiness in the mode of goodness. In the mode of goodness, that's like grammar. Conditioned by happiness in the mode of goodness. So the spiritual conception is not in real focus, like who am I as spirit soul and as part and parcel of the Supreme Soul, as his eternal servant. And the act of compassion and kindness is simply for the satisfaction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the one who is dispensing the well-being to others. It's not me. The mode of goodness has this false ego primary component. I am doing for others. And transcendental is, I am doing for Krishna. And so I'm Krishna's instrument. I'm doing for Krishna, and Krishna is doing for me. And it's clear. It's not like going in out of focus. It's very clear. That's transcendental. And so how can one discern? Language is one way of discerning. Quality is another way of discerning. Like in the 14th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna asks the very good question, what distinguishes the quality of one who is free from the modes of nature? And most importantly, how does one achieve that, being beyond the modes of nature? So look at the last verses of chapter 14, you'll find some detailed description. But the qualities are the transcendental qualities that aren't circumstance created. They're not, now you see it, now you don't. And then some, you know, that person becomes angry, or that person becomes whatever. It's not there. And nothing can provoke them. Have you seen Your Ever Well-Wisher, that documentary of Prabhupada's life? There's a little segment where a Bombay industrialist, Mr. Desai, narrates how, as a businessman, what do businessmen do? One of the things they do is they test another person to see what their weaknesses are, and then strike where the weaknesses are. So he said he tested Prabhupada to see, is he, you know, where his weaknesses are? Is he like, does he want pride, or does he want money, or does, what does he want? Where's his weakness? And he saw, he says, he had no weakness. It wasn't like he was doing for some purpose. He was doing entirely out of devotion for Krishna. And that won his heart. So when there's something for myself, that's not goodness. Excuse me, that's not transcendence. Where there's still some false ego and the business thing, I'll do and I get. Something is there in the quality of goodness. You get the satisfaction of philanthropic work. I work very hard, and I accumulate some wealth, and I use that wealth for good work. And from that I derive recognition and appreciation from others and a sense of contentment, or conditioned by the sense of happiness in the language of Bhagavad Gita. And one will find in the character of those persons there's a button. You push the button and the load of goodness disappears and something else appears.
Instead of hearing and not the body and the soul, we are still a long way from it.
Not only you. Go ahead.
So how do we get out of that situation? I'm not the body and the spirit, but I'm still not happy in that way.
Well, I'll say a few things. Keep chanting. Keep hearing the message, because it's purifying, and try to apply. Take the message into your practical life and try to apply it. And when you try to apply it, you'll, just like trying to be attentive when chanting, you realize, oh my goodness, how inattentive. I had no idea until I started trying to be attentive. And oh my goodness, how much I'm in the bodily conception as I'm trying to act in a spiritual non-bodily conception. But if you don't make that effort, you won't get that realization. You just carry on, you know, reciting the verses without applying them. So by applying. And exactly on the point of this verse is the submission to those who are qualified will help one become qualified. And in the submission to those who are qualified, it's not just, I'll get something from them, so therefore I submit to them. It's, in order to please them, let me fulfill the mercy that they're wishing to give to me in the mood of service. It's the mood of service, awakened mood of service to ultimately to Krishna, but to those who are qualified representing Krishna, who's supremely qualified, or who's giving the qualification to those who are qualified. It's submission to Krishna, in other words, that carries one beyond just, saying yes and behaving differently. Getting the realization. Realization comes by acting in knowledge and by associating with those who are qualified in the mood of service. That's a simple answer. Then applying it, okay? Then applying it. Simple, you have something?
Yeah, thank you, Guru Maharaj. And you were explaining about the compassion of the sages of Namashirani, and you mentioned that the purpose of bhakti, actually, I think I heard you equate bhakti with compassion. And the purpose of bhakti is compassion. And correct me if I didn't hear properly. Then I'm trying to understand that point. In the beginning, at least I see by myself, so much is focused on my personal purification and performing bhakti. Is it that as we mature, then we connect to the real purpose we have to do with compassion?
It's not that the premise wind back in the sequence of your question. There's a certain premise. It's not that the essence of bhakti is compassion. Rather, compassion is a symptom of one who is situated in the essence. One who is a devotee will have the quality of. It's one of the decorations of a devotee. Like this, you've heard this so many times. There are 26 qualities of a devotee, and one of them is primary or Swarup Lakshana, and the others are secondary, Tathastha Lakshana. But compassion is in the Tathastha Lakshana category, and the one is the essence, Krishna Eva Sharma. From that comes all the others, including compassion. So it's not on the premise, it's not that compassion is the essence of bhakti. Rather, one who is situated in bhakti will be compassionate. A saintly person will be compassionate. I would say the other way. Does it make sense that a harsh person is a saintly person? We don't expect that. Or a cruel person, a vicious person is a saint. We don't. It doesn't fit. Compassionate person. Now, how that gets exhibited may be diverse according to the personality of the saintly person. But the primary characteristic is Krishna and Krishna. So, something that will help, now back to your question, when we become matured or advanced in Krishna consciousness and bhakti, compassion for sure will be there. It will be a symptom of one's maturity. And separately, in the Madhyama stage, until we become truly advanced in the Madhyama stage, we practice compassion. Like book distribution and Harinam and Prasadam distribution and public festivals. And we take upon ourselves some inconvenience for the benefit of others. Although we may be thinking, it's fine. Something's less deep. But we're supposed to do it. Not necessarily out of compassion. We're supposed to do it. It's good for me. So, purification. It will purify me to go on book distribution, even though I'm intimidated by the public, and I'm a shy person, and it's like, oh my God, I guess I gotta do it though, because it's one of the things we do for purification. Kind of thing. Not necessarily out of compassion. But when, certainly when we become matured, the purpose is not, you know, I like it, I don't like it. The purpose is, it's service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's His desire. It's being an instrument of His desire. And we're in that consciousness. All those other negative and, you know, self-anchoridizing kinds of consciousness just fade. It's just being an instrument of the will of the Supreme. That help? Vaisheshika told a very nice story, I'll just repeat it. Something that he experienced. This was his, he gave class on Wednesday morning, and maybe some of you heard or saw his class live. Fantastic class. But he was describing an experience that he just had the previous weekend in Austin, Texas, where he was at a, outside of, I think he said a Gold's Gym or something like that. And here comes along this guy that, you know, carrying his bag of stuff, and he offered the book to the guy, and the guy was, no, I'm an atheist. But, you know, Vaisheshika just stayed lit up and, you know, spoke to the man, and then he started to listen, and started to listen more, and started to listen more, and then stopped and said, you know, I've been praying to God, I've been praying that, you know, I'm suffering so much. And my prayer has become so intense that I just, looking for the sign of God's intervening. And then you came. And Vaisheshika said, sometimes this is not exactly the dialogue, but something like this. But it's not me, I'm just an instrument. You know, I guess this is it, that this is the answer to your prayer. It's not me, it's the answer to your prayer. It's in this book, Bhagavad Gita. And the man got down because he had his bag and was on his, like, kneeling on the sidewalk to get his wallet. His wallet was inside his pants, which was inside the bag. And as he was fishing around, Vaisheshika was like kneeling down with him. And the man, she said, just started crying profusely. Tears, streams of tears coming. Saying, "No, God answered my prayer." It was like, it was an epiphany. He didn't even know what the book was exactly, but, you know, somehow he had that sense from the instrument that was presenting the book because of his qualities, Vaisheshika's qualities. So, we may be doing something that we like or we don't like. That's interesting, but that's not the essence. The essence is, what's the will of the Supreme, and if we can be the instrument of the will of the Supreme. We're clear what the Supreme wants, and we do that which is what the Supreme wants for the purpose of pleasing the Supreme. Compassion flows through that person. It's like, let's embarrass Govinda for just a moment. He's in Vrindavan for years doing 24-hour kirtan. Now he's coming to America and, you know, traveling and visiting and singing. And so what's his interest? Is his interest, you know, I want some recognition from people who say, oh, you sing very nicely. And if that's the case, it's going to make more layers of contamination. So he's praying to Krishna, please let me be an instrument. And if people say, oh, that's so nice, he's thinking, it's because the association I've had with Indra, in living in Vrindavan, and, you know, I know the impurities that are in my heart, but despite that, I've had this good fortune, and now I'm just like a little emissary of that good fortune. And until one is pure, there's going to be a mix. But, you know, when it becomes mature in Krishna consciousness, it's compassion and being an instrument of others who are truly compassionate. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his associates, and I just get an opportunity to be one of those, the servant of the servant of servant of those associates. That's my good fortune. although I'm unqualified. So like that, then one can feel real humility and be an instrument of the descending Mahabhadanyaya, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Otherwise, one is kind of, you know, in the way. At least ego is in the way, contamination in the way. It's not a full flow of genuine compassion. The essence is Krishna Ekrishan, from what Rupa Goswami is teaching. Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj. I was appreciating the analogy of the captain on the airplane, and I was considering that perhaps the stewardesses could be like an immediate authority or mentor. In other words, if the captain comes by and tells you to sit down, there's no question. Sometimes if the stewardess comes to me and says, yeah, yeah, I'll sit down.
Well, I've been in situations where, excuse me if you happen to be from India, but people from India don't pay attention. Like, you know, and the stewardess will stand up and, you know, repeat. You know, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. You know, and if they still stand up and still like rummage through the overhead locker, they'll, you know, they'll get really heavy. You know, the captain has said sit down. They're invoking the authority of the captain, and you get smacked if you don't do what the captain says. It's unlawful. You're a violation of federal law, although you may be in the air. Anyway, so the stewardess's authority is, you know, the federal law, and the captain is under the Pentagon. So, but it's law for safety's sake. They say it softly, unless somebody is like, you know, just doesn't pay attention. Then they escalate. I'm sure if somebody refused, they'd face a federal crime. I'm sure. It's federal law. You know, in different countries they have their law, but if it's in the United States or a United States aircraft, it's federal law. Anyway, is that the best question?
Yeah, so I guess the point is how to overcome sometimes the lack of faith or
respect for the persons who are representing.
Right.
I don't know, it's just 2 + 2 = 4, I guess. It's someone is a representative of Sakshat Hari Twal. I just had this discussion with Rabindra Sarup Prabhu. Sometimes there's this question, you know, during our prayers to the spiritual master, Sakshad Hari Trinasamasta Shastriya. And the question arises sometimes, who is that Sakshad Hari? And Rabindra's point is, the mistake that makes it difficult for them to understand the answer to that question is the word that follows is not just Sakshad Hari, it's Sakshad Hari Tvam, or Ness, having the quality of one becomes the person who is functioning as the spiritual master is not to be taken as Sakshad Hari, but Sakshad Hari Tvam. They have qualities invested in them by Hari, same. You know, so like the iron rod and the fire become like fire. So in response to your question, it takes a little refinement and a little education. You know, refinement of quality and little education, elevation through knowledge. It's, you know, like a child may not know how to respect someone. They behave in a disrespectful way. So that the parents give instructions that not only you to respect me, your parents, but you respect this other person for the following reasons and you do in the following way. So by quality and by training, one can get a proper understanding. And it's not just behavior, it's understanding. And quality through training and education. Okay. Last question.
This question is related to I would like to understand what is the difference between sentimental pain and true pain?
It's a little bit like the mode of goodness and transcendence. Remember all of that, just connect the two, and you got the answer to your question. It seems to me that such and such, I mean, I had a discussion with a brahmachari about this question recently, and so we go to the authority of scripture. Does it match what the authority of scripture says? I may have some faith in something. Now let me go look at scripture. Is it connected? Does it connect 100% with what scripture says? And then the other is, does it come and does it go? Is it circumstantially created, or is here for a while and then it disappears? Because sentiments come and go. But if it's rooted in the personality of Godhead, then it's like, it's fixed. When there's genuine shout from the personality of God, it's not depending upon circumstances, I feel some faith in something. Supposing the circumstances change and it becomes difficult or challenging, is my faith enduring? Or was it dependent upon the circumstances? And we're way past the D reading, 7:30. Thank you very much. I've got a really busy schedule and I'm not going to stop.